This episode was recorded back in November 2022. The reason it's taken so long is because I've been waiting for a response from Peterborough Prison as to why my phone number had been blocked after this interview. Young people. How are young people under 25 coping with the climate emergency? How do they feel about their futures, starting families or going to university? And what matters more, having a good job or doing everything they can to save society from collapsing? In this series of Tipping Points, I speak with young people who have taken extreme measures to address the greatest challenge humanity has ever faced. I have with me two members of the activist group Just Stop Oil. Anna Holland, who is 20, is one of the two who threw soup at Van Gogh's sunflowers, which shook the art world. And Louis McKechnie, who is 21, is calling from Peterborough Prison and is being held on remand, that is, to be kept in prison until his trial, for 6 months so far. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Louis, please tell me your story. How did you get here?
I was always quite aware of the climate crisis, living by the coastline. I knew all the houses that were going to be underwater before I'd grown old. My mother had a master's degree in climate science, so I really, you know, I grew up understanding the nature of the crisis and how it was a threat to me personally as well as everybody my age. Until I went to university, I never really knew what to do about it. It gave me a lot of anxiety. I was really worried for the future. I didn't know what would happen. I knew the government wasn't on track to do anything about it, and I was terrified. All the ways we were told, petition, speak to your MP, go into politics, none of them would work. You know, my mother had spent her whole life in politics as a Green Party councillor to try and protect my generation from the climate crisis, and it hadn't done anything. I then heard about Extinction Rebellion when I went to university. I ran my university Extinction Rebellion group for a while, and it really helped feeling like I wasn't powerless to the crisis. I could actually do something about it. April last year, I had my first address at Extinction Rebellion, an action called Rebellion of One. I was absolutely terrified. So I'd never considered getting arrested before. You know, I grew up in a family where getting in legal trouble was really frowned upon. So I thought I'd never get arrested. I'd never do anything like that. But it just felt like the right thing to do. And it took months and months of thinking about it. And the morning of, I was literally so anxious. I was throwing up into the toilet before leaving the house. But I went and did it and it changed my life. I finally felt like I was doing all I could to protect my future, and it felt really empowering. I felt for once not scared for my future. Then I joined Animal Rebellion. We occupied McDonald's, we blockaded dairy factories, we covered Buckingham Palace Mountain with red paint. It was both the scariest 2 weeks of my life, the most nerve-wracking, but also the most fulfilling 2 weeks I'd ever had. And I felt afterwards it was the happiest 2 weeks of my whole life. While it had quite serious legal repercussions, I finally felt something that makes me feel like I'm doing all I can for my generation and everybody at the front of the climate crisis. And so after that, I knew I had to leave university and to protect my future full time. I was studying mechanical engineering at the time. I wasn't passionate. I wasn't engaged. Then I found this, and I found something I was actually passionate about. And so then Insulate Britain came along. At the weekend after the first week of actions, I called up my friend and said, hey, I want to join. How do I do it? They said, next box in 2 days' time, you can join me if you want. And so I jumped in after thinking about it for less than a day, ended up having some of the best months of my life, living in safe houses with the most incredible people I could imagine, and getting arrested 3 times a week. Everything was always up in the air. You never knew what was going to happen 5 minutes from now. Ended up going to prison for breaking a high court injunction. I did 6 weeks. I was actually sentenced on my 21st birthday, not the birthday I was hoping for. I got out New Year's Eve and jumped straight back in. By the time I got on out, I'd been kicked out of university for bringing the university into disrepute because numerous news articles had appeared in the press about me, that I was a student at that university and what I'd been up to. So the university decided from a PR perspective they had to get rid of me. I started working for a group called Just Stop Oil as an action coordinator. And then the first phase of Just Stop Oil, we tossed Dell an estimated £4 billion in 2 weeks for those actions. And I felt like I'd been a part of something that really had made a difference. Along the way, I was scared, I was terrified, I was stressed, I was anxious, but I completely got rid of my climate anxiety. This was the only way the government would listen, because they haven't listened to anything else. After that wave of actions, we started planning the culture actions, like the football and the arts and the Formula One. For the football, it was the most terrifying thing I had ever done. I stopped a football match ever since I left Newcastle, locked my neck to a goalpost during the match, caused about 10 minutes of disruption. During that time, one of the fans jumped out of the crowd with a knife, trying to get to me. Security held him back. Another fan got out and booted me in the head before he was arrested. The Everton fans tried to give me an award, Everton Fan of the Year. And I was really looking forward to picking it up, but by the time the award ceremony came around, I found myself in prison again. This time I'd been remanded for the Formula One actions. So we went out on the Formula One track during a race, dropped the race, and got dragged off in under a minute. But it was a really powerful image. We'd spent hundreds of hours planning it to be as safe as possible. We knew with several safeguards that we would not actually be in personal danger, despite what it looked like. I think it was a real wake-up call to a lot of people seeing these actions. 3 days before the Formula One action, I was glued to a Van Gogh painting, Peach Trees and Blossom. It seemed we got a real foothold in the art world after those actions. Certain big names in the art community are now on side and supporting us, and people are starting to see these actions and take notice. Been on remand, 4.5 months now? And every week I get letters of people saying they saw these actions and it's taken them away from the disempowerment they felt before and start to make them step up into action and take charge of their future because the government failed to. Often they don't put their age in the letters. Seems to be a mix completely across the board. Every type of person from every type of background. It seems that through our actions, so many, not even just in the UK, but around the world, are starting to realise there is something we can do to protect ourselves. I'm currently calling from prison over the phone in my cell. And I've got to say, prison is really, really dull. Everybody thinks, oh, prison's this, prison's that. The only real problem I've faced in my time here is boredom. A lot of people ask me what it's like, and it's not really like anything. Nothing really happens. Like movie Groundhog Day, just living the same day over and over again.
I wonder if, Anna, you could give us a rundown of your story so far.
Yeah, absolutely. So I first became aware of not just the climate crisis, but just how scary the world was and how fragile my future looked. When I was around 13, 14, that's when I really started paying attention to the news. I grew up in a very like heavily forested area, and through the course of my teenage years, that forest has just shrank as it's been deforested for the sake of new housing developments. £1 million houses going up that no one's ever going to be able to afford. So for a few years, I built up this continual anxiety, the state of the world around me. And I didn't know what to do about it. I felt like, you know, I was the only one suffering with this. But, you know, all my friends, they were just worrying about, you know, who got invited to what party and who asked who out in high school. And I'd say like, yeah, but people are dying. Why is no one talking about this? And then in 2018, I heard about Extinction Rebellion for the first time. And I was way too scared to try and join them because my family are very much, you know, they won't do anything to rock the boat. They very much keep their head down and just work though. I sort of like very quietly supported Extinction Rebellion for about a year, thinking, oh my goodness, these people are just the coolest. I wish I could be one of them. And then in 2019, when the school strikes came, when there's a fantastic period of time where students across the country were walking out of schools and taking part in demonstrations, that's the first thing I ever did for climate activism was I snuck out of college, got the train to Manchester, and took part in one of their biggest school strikes. I think that was the one where about 3,000 people showed up. It's a massive event for me. And it was just completely life-changing. It was the first time I felt what I was doing was going to really make a difference. And I was surrounded by people who all spoke the same language as me, finally. After that, I spent, I think, the next 3 years working with climate groups in Manchester, predominantly Youth Strike for Climate Manchester. And we organised marches, petitions, letters to our MPs, festival campaigning. And then in 2021, after I'd done some organising with Kill the Bill, which was the protest movement targeting the Police Crime and Sentencing Bill, it hit me that nothing that I had done up until that point had made any difference. The government was still ignoring us. So after that, I spent about a year where I just didn't really do anything for the climate. I just completely fell victim to my climate anxiety. I felt like nothing I did made a difference. I felt completely overwhelmed. You know, I barely even looked at the news anymore. I didn't talk to my friends about what really mattered to me. I barely went on social media. And it was just one of the hardest years of my life. I was so miserable during that year. It was really awful. And then one of my friends sort of bullied me into going to a Just Stop Oil talk. It just really finally like snapped me out of this fog I'd been in for the past year. There were these people talking to us saying, yeah, the world's terrible. It's really scary. But we're doing something about it. We have plans. We did these actions in April. They worked. We made a difference. We're going to make a difference again. And we're not going to stop until our demand of no new oil is met. And it was incredible. I was like, oh my God, this is... It was about a week after that talk, I did my first arrestable action. I stopped an oil tanker outside of the Kingsbury Oil Terminal. That felt so terrifying. There's nothing scarier than, you know, being sat on this road and seeing this massive oil tanker just racing towards you. So I got arrested. And even though it was my first arrest for obstruction of the highway, I was held on remand for 30 hours. You never really see people get held for that long on the first arrest. And I'm still not sure why they held me so long. It still felt like I was in the right place. This was where I was supposed to be. All the people on my team were in the cells across from me, in the cells on the road down from me. I was like in a cell by myself. I was surrounded by people who most of them I'd only met the day before, but I cared so much about them. You just form these bonds with these people, these connections with people in Just Stop Oil so quickly because of, you know, the high pressure situation that we're in. But then all my charges got dropped. I just got to go back home again. And then I was down in London taking part in the monthly civil resistance. You know, you're sat in a row, people on either side of you who you care about more than anything. And you just think, no matter what happens, I've got my people here. I've got my community around me. Even though, you know, we had all these angry people yelling at us, threatening, I still felt completely safe and in control because of the people I was taking action with. But even then, I felt like I could still be doing more. Like, I really wanted to do something that would just shock everyone and force people to just stop for a second and think about how absurd it is that we're still, like, going about our ordinary daily lives when scientists are predicting we're going to run out of clean drinking water by 2040. You know, people, we needed people to just finally listen to us and pay attention to us. So that's where the super action came from. Phoebe and I were told about the plans for the super action 2 days before it happened. And then the day before it happened, we went to the gallery. You know, we brought soup in our bags. We went to the shop beforehand. We bought loads and loaves of bread and like nice drinks and snacks and stuff just to make it look like we were two students on our lunch break or something. And then Phoebe came back to my safe house. And we spent that night in my shower throwing soup at the glass door to try and practice it and get like just work out the best way to throw soup. And which is, again, so weird. We made such a mess in the bathroom. Yeah, I'm so glad that I had other people there to help us clean up. And then, yeah, on that day, on the Friday, we threw the soup at the Van Gogh painting. And it was, I knew it was going to be a big action, but I didn't realize just how big it was going to be. I had no idea just how international it was going to go, how quickly people were going to form these opinions about me and Phoebe, how quickly people got so defensive and so protective over the painting. Since then, interview after interview, it's both received a lot of hate on the internet and in real life. Even though what we did was massively controversial, I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud that we did it, and I am just so ready to do as much as possible to get this victory that we so desperately need. So, yeah.
You mentioned doing activism in a group helped you to feel like you had some strength, but I wonder, Louis, because you did that zip tie action on the goalposts totally on your own. So this is quite a different experience. What was it like to be there with no one else around you? when you're being booed and booted for 10 minutes by a stadium of people?
Yeah, it was really challenging. I think the adrenaline was pumping so hard that I kind of tuned a lot of it out. But I didn't actually go there alone. One of my best friends came along and filmed it from the stand. So I wasn't alone until I was actually out on the pitch. And I don't think I would have been able to follow through with it if I was truly alone there. I was so nervous before. I was throwing up in the toilet at halftime, 10 minutes before I went out. It was really, really scary, that stadium of 40,000 people that I knew would absolutely hate my guts for it. By the time I'd actually done it, the adrenaline was pumping so hard that I don't fully remember all of it. I just remember feeling so focused, so, I guess, in flow that I kind of tuned out the crowd. I didn't really hear them. And then only afterwards, at the police station, when the officer was saying, oh, they were chanting Wanker at you and all this and that, I was like, were they? I didn't even realise. I definitely couldn't have done an action like that if I hadn't had so much experience of being arrested beforehand. You know, it gets a lot easier as you go. One other thing I would like to mention is the reaction from everybody in prison, Anna, when you did the sunflower action, was incredible. Everybody knew about it. It was like the hot topic of the town for like over a week. Prisoners were coming up to me and shaking my hand, saying that's really, really cool. A lot of them were actually inspired to maybe join us when they get out because they saw that and saw how much it blew up. A lot of the officers came to me and spoke to me privately in the cell, saying how grateful they were for it and how they were worried for their children. And now seeing actions like Soup on the Sunflowers really gave them hope. It resonates everywhere.
Wow. That must be a nice thing to hear.
Oh, yeah, that's so exciting to hear. You always hear the hateful comments more than you hear the ones of support. The people who don't like you will always be louder than the people who are supportive of whatever you do. So thrilling to hear that we've even made it through to people in prison who now are wanting to join us when they get out. That's so thrilling. That's so exciting.
Do you think that the people in prison might be more willing to join a group like JSO because maybe they feel a great sense of disempowerment?
A lot of people in prison have been failed by the system, have been failed by the state through their whole lives. You know, none of them are bad people per se. They just often come from very disadvantaged backgrounds and the government hasn't done anything to help them. So they understand what the government failing its people looks like. You know, they have a better grasp on how the system actually works than a lot of the people on the outside do. A lot of the people in here have a lot more time to think about these large scale issues and not all the distractions a lot of people find in day-to-day lives to stop themselves thinking about these big issues, because it's too scary to think about for a lot of people. A lot of people here didn't really understand the climate crisis before I talked to them about it, but they're all very willing to listen and learn, it seems. There's a lot more wanting to hear about other people's stories in here. Everybody's got an interesting thing to say, whereas I think from the outside we get dismissed as, you know, crazy radicals or whatever, and people just don't listen to a word we say just because it's uncomfortable to consider that we might be right with what we're doing. A lot of them haven't really considered the state's actual role and how it's failing to protect our future. It's easier to look away and call us crazy radicals than it is to accept that there's a real issue that the government isn't doing anything about.
Yeah. Both of you mentioned a little bit about the hatred that you receive from the public. And I wanted to know if JSO had trained you at all for how to deal with that kind of visceral response that was inevitable from your actions that you did.
Yeah. First of all, Louis, with regards to the hate you've been getting for your football action, I've actually had a few people, so when we mobilised in Newcastle, we usually start a conversation with, have you heard about Just Not Oil? And I've had a few people go, well, yes, I'm a Newcastle fan. And at that moment, I always go, oh my God, is this going to go wrong? But there's been a surprisingly large number of people go, yeah, even though, you know, Louis completely ruined the game for us, I get where he's coming from. I'm completely behind him on that. So you're not hated by all of Newcastle, if that's any consolation for you. But one of the things Just Uphold does really well is the preparation that they give to everyone going into action. So obviously we're a peaceful group. We use nonviolent direct action and we do trainings in that. person is not allowed to go on an action with us unless they've done their nonviolent direct action training. Part of that training is how to stay completely calm and focused and in control, regardless of whatever hate you may receive actually on the action. We do lots of like role plays in that training where we'll pretend to be on a roadblock, and you know, some people pretend to be like angry members of the public. So that's a really fantastic way of helping people just learn what the best tools are to help them feel grounded and focused during action when they're getting that hate, you know, in real time, one-to-one. Internet hate and hate from people like post-action. Phoebe and I were both very prepared to get that hate. So there's this great community of people who have been there before you. They've been in that situation where they've been getting hate. They really helped to guide me and Phoebe through what to expect with the hate. And even as after the action, Phoebe and I have both been in a group chat with a few other more notorious people in Just Stop Oil, I suppose, who've been constantly checking in with us, making sure that we're doing okay, and just sort of keeping tabs on how we've been responding to the hate comments and how we've been feeling about the hate comments. There's not been one moment where I felt like I didn't have someone who couldn't empathize with me, or who I couldn't talk to someone about whatever I was seeing on the internet about myself and Phoebe.
Me, I couldn't do any of these actions that I've done without the support network that's in place. For me, I guess when I got involved, it felt like a little bit of a leap of faith. You know, I've been told about all these ways that you'll be supported throughout the process, but because I hadn't experienced it myself, I didn't really know if it would be there or not. And it was, and it made sure that I was perfectly okay whatever happened. It was mentioned the 8-hour NVDA training that really helped a lot, a full day of training how to be on actions, how to keep non-violent and in a good headspace. But also things like they provide therapy and counselling if you need it from a network of volunteers, which is really, really effective and it's helped me massively. They prepare you for interviews however you want, make sure you're comfortable doing them. And, you know, from the football action, I got hundreds of death threats online, and I was supported as well as anyone could have been through that by the team. I would like to think that even if everybody else wasn't here, I'd do it on my own. Realistically, I don't think anybody can do this on their own. Thanks to the support that they've given me through these actions, I'm closer to a lot of these people than I am some of my own family at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially through prison, they do massive support for us in here. Whatever I need, sending books, sending clothes, sending money when I need it. Massive amount of people emailing in support and writing letters and postcards in support. The last prison I was in up in Liverpool.
He's on the 20-minute timer.
Okay.
Person currently in a prison in England. All calls are logged and recorded and may be listened to by a member of prison staff. If you do not wish to accept this call, please hang up now.
Louis, I wanted to ask about the possibility here of vulnerable people being involved with JSO recruitment. If people are feeling totally disempowered, but they're also vulnerable, could they fall into JSO recruitment?
Yeah, I personally haven't seen that happen. There's so much support, not just around arrest, but around the recruitment process, around getting new people. If there are any vulnerable people, this isn't the best place for them. We're not going to send anyone out to do any sort of high-stakes action or any sort of arrestful action or anything like that unless we are completely confident that this is the best thing for them and it's not going to be derivative to them in any way.
I was around when we first formed the youth part of Just Stop Oil at the very start, and we spent a very long time discussing this. It was one of the key issues that all of us wanted to make sure we'd address beforehand, so it didn't, you know, end badly for anybody involved. We basically designed the mobilisation process to make sure everybody's in a good place. We can't have people heavily involved in this who aren't really, because it's a tremendous amount of responsibility you take when you step up to this stuff. And so we need to make sure everybody who is doing it isn't in a vulnerable situation. And if they are, because when recruiting we have found a few people, in my experience we've always said we want to support you through what you're going through, but only after you are ready, then we'd be happy for you to come get involved with us more.
Thanks. Anna, as a queer person, do you fear what prison might be like? Is going to prison a barrier for queer people?
That is something that really does concern me. So I identify as non-binary, so I use they, them pronouns. And, you know, I already know if I were to be sent to prison, I would be sent to a woman's prison. But the vast majority of the people we have on remand right now from Just Stop All are queer people, even though it is such a scary thing to consider as a queer person. I take massive inspiration from them. And also from queer history, you know, I wouldn't be here today as a queer person. Yeah, I wouldn't be able to vote, get a job, you know, one day marry the person I love if it wasn't for civil disobedience, if it wasn't for queer people who came before me and were arrested before me. The majority of queer liberation actions happened in the 70s, 80s, 90s, suffered far worse consequences for being queer than I will have to face. I almost owe it to those who fought to get me this far and to continue that fight so that future queer people, you know, the queer people in the younger generation won't have to face the same kind of discrimination from the justice system.
I guess generally prisons are a bit behind the times of political correctness. I can't speak for women's prisons, but in men's prisons, it certainly feels like there is a little bit of a stigma. And it's quite a big issue that a lot of my friends have had when risking this stuff. Because, you know, prison can be a lot more difficult than I've never heard in this prison of anybody getting assaulted or hurt because of it. But there is a sort of schoolyard gay bashing mentality in here, making a lot of jokes inappropriately, that sort of stuff. I'm not really sure how to deal with it in here. I try to address it when I can, but it certainly seems like a lot of the people in here just think it's jokes and don't see it has a real effect on people. And my friends who still risk this stuff, them still being willing to do this comes down to whatever risks or judgments there are in prison. It's still a lot less than the risk that the climate crisis poses to us. Some people it may discourage, but many it hasn't.
It's encouraging to hear, Louis, that you haven't heard any instances of people being assaulted for being queer. I have the same assumption about prison, that people in prison would just be a lot more free with their language. I have massive respect for you, Louis, for trying to stand up against it where you can in prison. Because
when I was on the induction wing here, when you come in prison, you go to an induction wing for the first week or so before you moved on to a permanent wing. And on that wing, I made friends with a trans woman who has been in prison for about 6 months. And I talked to them about this. And they basically explained it to me. There's a lot of schoolyard chatting shit. But generally speaking, everybody has been respectful to them, to their faith. And they haven't had any major difficulties with this experience because of that. That's just a single person that I've met. Might not be representative for everybody's experience.
The question I wanted to ask about the soup action, when you were throwing the soup, you knew that there was glass protecting the painting, and that was purposefully not broadcast to try to stir up the media and stir up the anger and stir up the publicity as much as possible. But if there wasn't glass on it, would you still have done it?
I personally don't think I would have done it if there wasn't glass in front of it. But I think the general consensus within Just Stop Oil is that someone still would have gone ahead with that action, even if there wasn't glass, because since our action, so many people have been so outraged just as for quote-unquote destroying this painting. Why are people so upset about one painting when millions of people are dying because of the climate crisis? You know, we had 2 days of 40-degree heat this summer, and that killed 1,700 people in the UK. That burnt down 60 homes. 40-degree heat, scientists didn't predict that was going to happen until 2050. And it's already happening now. The progression of the climate crisis is so much more rapid than anyone has been able to predict so far. And we're coupling that with food shortages that have been expected for next year. So we need people to stop getting angry at soup on a painting and start getting angry at the fact that nurses using food banks. my university has set up a food bank for its students now. We need people to be angry at the government.
Although I guess the soup throwing was to make it more obvious that people's anger should be channeled towards more systemic problems that the government needs to address, to show that the defacing a painting is so tiny compared with the failures of governments to address the global inequalities and the drivers of the rapidly changing climate and attack on nature. So what needs to change for people to realise that they should be channeling that anger at the policymakers rather than shooting the messengers like you?
Well, we've already seen quite an encouraging change in how the media and how journalists and reporters are responding to us. And we've seen a massive shift in how reporters are talking about us and how they're interviewing us, how they talk about the climate crisis. Because even just this time last year, a lot of reporters who were interviewing us were questioning the science behind the climate crisis. They were not agreeing with us that things are as extreme and as severe as they really are. But now we've seen this fantastic shift in reporters agreeing with us about the science, agreeing with our message, they're agreeing that we don't need new oil. There's this fantastic interview that Alex de Koning did for, I believe it's World at One or maybe BBC Scotland, where he talks about the mass extinction of the human race. And the reporter, because, you know, she was caught off guard, went, well, yes, I know that, which was truly fantastic to hear. We understand at just some point we're not going to be able to convince the entire public that they need to be angry at the government and not us. But if we can convince the journalists and the reporters to actually do their job and report on the fact that our governments are criminal, the fact that they've been found criminal by the High Court, to report on these planned blackouts while the head of BP said he has more cash than he knows what to do with, then the public are more likely to listen to that. The biggest pressure we need right now is to go towards the reporters and journalists so they can actually report on the crisis. This is such a massive threat, it should be front page news every day. And it just isn't. But right now, front page news is who's eaten what on I'm a Celeb, when in the grand scheme of things, that's not important. What's important is the climate crisis.
Louis, I wonder if you can tell us how important you think the media is in making the world habitable.
The media might just have more power than the current government does. Murdoch's media empire, four billionaires owning half the press, so many of the public subconsciously being controlled in how they think by the mass media. When you're bombarded with an idea hundreds of times over, it sinks in, especially the framing of these issues is incredibly biased and does affect the way the general public perceives the world and how they can interact with it. Certainly the biggest barrier we have to effective action on climate is the mass media as it stands. If the mass media reported the climate crisis honestly and accurately and the risks involved, and the science is already there, we do have the path to get out of this mess. I mean, not entirely, of course. We can mitigate it. If the media actually portrayed the effective steps we could as a country take to mitigate this crisis, I think the people would push for it. But the fact that they don't just shows how biased the media is and how much oil money is in the media as it stands. We don't have a free media in this country. We don't have a fair media. The media is owned by large corporations with vested interests. And as soon as we start realising that, I think it will make a massive social change happen in this country. And we'll be able to, in mass, demand better. You know, the government controls what is heard on the BBC and what isn't. But of course, occasionally, the BBC will stray from that to show that they are independent. But you can see more by what they don't cover than what they do, where their biases lay. The fact that they talk about carbon footprint all the time, an idea that was invented by Shell and BP to shift blame onto consumers, shows that they are just as in the pocket of big oil as any of the other mass medias, which we expect to be biased.
I spoke with Madeline Finlay, who is a journalist for The Guardian Science Weekly. What questions to ask you? She said, in the climate emergency, what should the role of journalists look like? Does it become more than just reporting the news? And for journalists to reflect on as well, what is enough? How do we engage, entertain, and inspire action?
So far, generally across the board, journalists have failed the people they're meant to inform in terms of accurately portraying the climate crisis in the enormity that it is. One headline a month isn't enough from the perspective of climate crisis, the biggest threat to our lives every second of every day. You know, hearing about it maybe on page 5 of the paper a few times a month isn't enough. When we, as Just Stop Oil, did press meetings, only a handful of journalists would show up. But for big corporations, there are hundreds of journalists show up. All it would really take away public opinion on action needed on the climate crisis in a timely manner would be the front page of every paper for 3 days. That would convince, I believe, the general public to force the government to take action. Now, any less than that isn't enough.
I agree with you. I think that this is exactly what we need. But from a one single journalist perspective, when they want to feel that sense of empowerment, but they feel that that's the goal, that might seem unachievable to a journalist.
For individual journalists, it comes down to framing the climate crisis in a way that actually connects with people. We know stats don't sink in. We know facts don't stick in people's heads. What sticks in people's heads is powerful pictures, powerful words. Writing actually how the climate crisis will affect them and their loved ones and how people are already dying, painting this picture very vividly in people's heads, that's the best thing they can do. And alongside the message that we can do something about it, only if we act right now. 2 years from now is too late.
Yeah, I completely agree with Louis. You know, it's easy enough to connect intellectually with the facts of the climate crisis, but now we need people to connect emotionally. We need people to be able to form that emotional connection to realise the true urgency of the situation. So I think that's something that all journalists, even on an individual basis, can work on. Is it's so easy to connect emotionally to the climate crisis once you know where to look. On a wider level, since my soup action, I've done more interviews than I can count. And within Just Stop Oil as a whole, we've had spokespeople giving interviews multiple times a day. And often we get interview requests from the same media outlets, sort of like on a weekly basis. And every single time in every single interview, we are just asked the same question. Aren't we worried we're going to put people off? How do we feel about our methods? There are so many interviews where we've given the same answers. We need journalists and reporters to just stop asking the same easy questions and getting the same easy answers. Everyone knows about Just Stop Oil's methods. Everyone knows that we're controversial. They've done that. They've reported on that. Now we need more reporting on the government. We need more people to understand that the climate crisis and the cost of living crisis is a direct result of our government's greed. People need to understand that. They need to understand that this cost of living crisis is man-made and it's been made by the governments in charge and by their neglect of us. And they need to understand that the climate crisis, which is shortening all of our life expectancy, the reason why we've had such awful weather this year that's been killing people, is because of our government's neglect. And again, that capitalisation is man-made. We need journalists to be reporting on that and not just on, oh, do you not realise that there's oil in your superglue? Because that's not constructive.
Yeah, the way that the media talk about you guys is also kind of interesting. Because if we look back in history, we see Anne Hunt, who was a suffragette, who took a meat cleaver to a portrait in 1914 for the women's vote. And the British press then dubbed her as a hatchet fiend and the fury with a chopper. But at that time, the museums banned women from entering the museums unless they were accompanied by a man. And that's the kind of world that people were living in then. But the media, even at that time, and still do now, report the fury against that injustice and the fury against that system with these kinds of horrendous terms. So how have the media dubbed both of you, and why do you think that is?
So I've been branded eco-vandal, eco-zealot, anti-government anarchist, whatever, a million and one things. I don't tend to especially listen, because I know half of what the media says is bullshit anyway. But my biggest problem with them is they frame it as a personal problem that I have against the government, and not the fact the government is stabbing every person my age in the back, marching us off a cliff and expecting us not to do anything. They never report that what we're doing is proportionate to the crisis or even necessary to get the government to take action. They never accurately report on history of social change. and how what we're doing has a lot of precedent. They always seem to frame us as the people with the problem and not all of society with the problem if we don't do something.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. The media has been entirely too individualistic with us. Yeah, I've been given almost every negative nickname you could probably imagine. And the media are doing that predominantly just because snappy nicknames will sell. They need catchy headlines. They need things that will get them, things to get make it more popular. And so far, they think that the way to do that is by tapping into what is believed to be the hate that the majority of the public feels for us. They think the majority of the public do hate us and agree that we're eco-zealous, eco-warriors and all of that. There was that recent poll that was just done just a few weeks ago, reported by The Guardian, saying that 66% of people, that's two-thirds of the population, agree that civil resistance is needed to fight the climate crisis. So these awful nicknames that they're giving us, it's not well-founded logic to be calling us that, because it's simply not appealing to the majority anymore. More and more people are beginning to understand where we're coming from, why we're doing this, and they're beginning to agree with us. Calling us eco-zealous, that's boring, really. That's been done.
I've noticed as well, like when during interviews that you guys have had, that they've constantly said your cause. I'm thinking, what? This isn't an individual thing. And it winds me up when I hear it. I want to bring that down to a more personal level, in a sense that with relationships with family and friends, in my experience, people, my family and friends were in the early stages of my activism, worried about whether I had been brainwashed, whether I'd been extreme, going and doing things because I felt that something needed to be done rather than something just needs to be done and I happen to be doing it. So I wonder if either of you have experienced a change in dynamic and a change in response from family and friends during your period of activism.
Yeah, for me, I haven't had too much of that. I guess I'm one of the very fortunate ones in that my family has always understood it, why I've been doing this. I mean, they've always been very proud of me. My mum having a master's in climate science really helped with them understanding the perspective. Growing up, the heroes of the household were Nelson Mandela and Rosa Parks and those sorts of people.
Mm.
My family already understood that this is the way you make a change. This is the way historically that works.
Mm.
And so they've always been very proud of me for doing it and haven't once tried to talk me out of it or judge me for it. I've lost a lot of friends doing it. That was somewhat to be expected. A lot of them have been quite judgmental, not willing to listen to why. But I'm not especially unhappy about that, because the friends I've made in their place seem to be a lot more supportive and kind and generally more kind-hearted people that I've met through this process.
So I haven't seen that change too much from my friends and family, mostly because I never spoke to them much about my activism before. You know, the whole world knew that I was an activist. Before the Sooth Action, my immediate family obviously knew. They did worry that, you know, I'd just been swept along with this, just swept up with this great group. Since then, I've noticed that changed a lot more with my friends. I've had so many discussions and so many arguments with lots of friends I grew up with from high school, college, and even my friends in university, who initially didn't understand why I felt the need to get arrested. But recently, a lot of them have become a lot more understanding. And I think a lot of that has been helped by doing things like this, by doing interviews like this on podcasts, on like the articles, the news, where it really helps just humanize us so much more, which has really helped, especially my mum comes to terms with what I've been doing. Because at first, she was very upset at what I did with my action. But since talking to her more, I've shown her a few more positive articles about me. And that has really helped her just understand that I'm doing these actions because as it stands, I don't see a future for myself. And I don't see a future for my little sisters, for my nieces and nephews. That doesn't exist right now in my mind. If it does, it's bleak and horrible and terrifying. And now my friends are starting to realize that they see the same future that I see. I've had so many more people recently talk to me from a perspective of, thank you for doing this for me, because I never could do something like that. They see what I did as brave now, rather than misguided or stupid or, you know, mistaken. So I think that's been a really important change.
Thank you. This is the end of the first interview with Louis and Anna. We had scheduled to continue the conversation the week after, but unfortunately Louis was unable to join the call because the prison had blocked my number. Neither of us were told that this would happen, nor indeed why it would happen. I called the prison to find out more information, which will be included at the end of the next episode.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker, commissioned by the Climate Music Project, who communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.